Well, good morning. Time to get used to the old surroundings, different placement of speakers and all that. But anyway, we'll adjust. Change is such a terrible thing. Yeah, I've finally got my wife convinced that the bedroom's fine just like it is. Else, I mean, you might jump in bed and not be there. It wouldn't be good.
How'd you convince her?
Patient persistence and bribery. No, she's it's been very wonderful to get along with. Good to see Carson with us today. And all of you, welcome, welcome. Seems that we're on another temperature swing. We had really cold temperatures for a little while this week, and I actually was very grateful for that. The ground froze enough, we could get some logs out, but then I saw it was supposed to thunderstorm Saturday night. Well, I didn't quite get that. It went south of us, but this part of the country, we can have some pretty wide swings in a hurry. Anyway, glad you're all here today. We don't have ice or some other form of frozen water. We've been studying Isaiah, and not Isaiah 2 today, but last week we read in chapter 13, and we noted that it was the beginning of a new section of Isaiah where Isaiah delivers a series of burdens, as he puts it, or as it's translated, against different named and implied entities in his world. And we read here in chapter 13 the burden of Babylon last week, and we need to revisit it just a little bit because there's some aspects of the way it's laid out that are typical of Isaiah's style in general that we need to be aware of. So clearly the chapter begins with the words, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, did see. But as we read here in the first part of this, the language is much more directed toward a wider range tumult. And in fact, in verse 6, he uses an expression which is typical of a number of prophets in the Old Testament. He talks about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is at hand. And the day of the Lord is the description of a much more worldwide kind of disruption, destruction, day of judgment. Babylon is sort of a small example of that, but not the ultimate end. And so it's not until we get down to verse 17, whenever Isaiah then begins to speak more specifically about Babylon. So let me read those first verses again and notice how that they have much broader connections in their scope. Verse 2 starts, "Lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain, exalt the voice unto them, shake the hand that they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of the battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord and the weapons of his indignation, to destroy the whole land. Howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt. They shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrows shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain, as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. And he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. For I will punish the world for their evil. So you see the universal, much broader scope of this discussion. And the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a man more precious than fine gold. That is, as we talked last week, hard to find, scarce. Even a man than the gold wedge of Ophir. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place, in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. And it shall be as the chaste roe, or deer, and as a sheep that no man taketh up. They shall every man turn to his own people, and flee every one unto his own land. As it were, seeking some place of stability and security, turning to what you know. Every one that is found shall be thrust through, and every one that is joined unto them shall fall by the sword. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled, their wives ravished. And then he goes more specifically into a description of the fall of Babylon. And as we talked about, this fall of Babylon, that is, of the ancient city, wasn't also a destruction initially when it, Babylon fell many times. And so the most near to Isaiah's day of the fall of Babylon was in
689,
I believe was the date, whenever the Assyrians destroyed Babylon. Destroyed it. We read about it last week. The Assyrian Emperor Sennacherib, wasn't it? Said, I took it down from the roof to the foundation and dumped it in the river. That's pretty much a destruction. And so a little over a century, it was built back to its grandest ever. Under the Chaldeans, under Nebuchadnezzar. And it was that kingdom, that stage of Babylon, that Isaiah foresaw as being the ones who would take Judah and Jerusalem captive. But he looks far into the future and sees there's a time whenever, in spite of its grandeur, in spite of its greatness, it shall be destroyed. And Isaiah, throughout what we've read so far, has been a constant advocate for putting your trust in God. People are looking in their day at the world powers, the superpowers that existed, Egypt, Assyria, a little later Babylonia, and they are looking for ways to find security in that world. They are forming allegiances. They are signing treaties. They are paying tribute. And in the process, they are importing the cultures of these foreign governments. That's a very typical thing that happens. Whoever is the strongest culture in the world, the world tends to mimic them. I mean, you can go to the far reaches of Asia, the South Pacific, most anywhere in this world, and you'll see people doing the kind of things that we do here. The stuff that they see in movies and the stuff they see on TV. Which, okay, that's a little different than the kind of things we do here. But at any rate, it's the culture that they think is a part of America. And so, don't you know, those same kinds of things are going on in the ancient world as well. We know very explicitly how a few centuries later, Alexander the Great exported Greek culture on purpose and with intent to all the world that he conquered. And it is only natural as well that during the period that Isaiah lives, that he sees the influence of these nations, these foreign nations, as they dominate in people's minds in terms of their power and potential partners in security, they're going to also be exporting their idolatry and their gods. One thing you want to remember about the ancient world, the Assyrians in particular come to mind, although it's true in general, these folks weren't pagans in the sense that they didn't believe in religion. They were very, very religious people. And they were intent on extending the power of their gods around the world. The Assyrians, when they conquered another people group, they would go to their temples and take their images and take them home and put them in the house of their gods to show that they were conquered. This even your gods are serving our gods, right? That was a little frustrating with the Jews because they didn't have any images, at least they weren't supposed to. And how do you take an image of Jehovah right back to Nineveh, wherever the capital of the Assyrians is at the time?
That's ironic.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, they were very religious people. And so they tended and intended to export their religious beliefs as well as their power throughout their conquests. And so Isaiah here is very insistent on the absolute importance of maintaining your trust for your security in Jehovah, because in fact he controls history. And there will be a time when his day, the day of the Lord, will dominate the world and there will be judgment. Now, I did a search on that expression to give you just a general flavoring of how that shows up in the Old Testament. It's already happened once in Isaiah. In Isaiah 2, verse 12, we have this. He says, "For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low." Okay? Then twice here in Isaiah 13, once in Jeremiah, Jeremiah says, "For this is the day of the Lord of hosts, a day of vengeance, that he may avenge him of his adversaries, and the sword shall devour. And it shall be satisfied and made drunk with their blood, for the Lord God of hosts hath a sacrifice in the north country by the river Euphrates." Ezekiel speaks of the day of the Lord. "Ye have not gone up into the gaps, neither made up the hedge for the house of Israel to stand in the battle in the day of the Lord." Joel, a number of times, speaks of the day of the Lord. Alas for the day of the Lord is at hand. And as a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. Okay, so a day of judgment. Chapter 2, verse 31, he speaks of the great and terrible day of the Lord. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood. And so that there again, that's a powerful image that is a metaphor. It speaks of the darkening of nations by their loss of leadership, their loss of existence even. When I was young, I tried to comprehend it as a literal expression. I mean, God can darken the sun if he wants to darken the sun. Don't get me wrong. He made it to start with. But in practical terms, if the sun goes out, we're not toast. We're deep freeze here real quick. And so if you're going to eliminate everything on earth, that'd be one way to do it. There again, the image of the moon becoming blood, we sometimes have atmospheric conditions that create a red moon, and that was often seen as a bad omen in the ancient world. So there again, it's connected in people's minds with ominous things that are coming. Amos is an interesting contemporary of Isaiah. He says, "Woe to you that desire the day of the Lord. To what end is it for you? The day of the Lord is darkness and not light. As if a man did flee from a lion and a bear met him. Or he went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall and a serpent bit him." You think you're safe and it gets worse, right? I don't know if there were some people who we might consider ultra spiritual who thought, oh, if we only had the day of the Lord. Anyway, he responds, no, you don't want that. It's not what you think. Shall not the day of the Lord be darkness and not light, even very dark, and no brightness in it? And as you can see, we have Obadiah, Zephaniah, Zechariah, and Malachi also make references to this day of the Lord. So Isaiah is on common ground there in his use of that expression and in his picturing it as a worldwide kind of judgment where God brings justice to the world. And that's not a good thing if you're on the wrong side of righteousness. Continues to be echoed then in the New Testament. 2 Peter, we have the day of the Lord shall come as a thief in the night. And Paul talks about salvation in the day of the Lord. Okay, so that is something we see going on then in the first part of chapter 13 of Isaiah. Then the transition to speak more specifically about ancient Babylon. We saw some pictures of how it ended up much later. And so then Isaiah 14 starts with these words, sort of a change of thought. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land. And the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. Okay. So this is a beautiful contrast to all the death and destruction that sin brings. This is a picture of working together. of coming together, of being united. Wow, what an awesome idea. And the people shall take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and handmaids. And they shall make them captives whose captives they were, and they shall rule over their oppressors. So a huge reversal of roles. And these, of course, are amazing things to read. If you are in the position of being a captive, if you are oppressed by a tyrant, it's hard for you to imagine those roles being reversed. Isaiah says, trust in the Lord, that's going to happen. And it shall come to pass in the day that the Lord shall give thee rest from thy sorrow and from thy fear and from the hard bondage wherein thou wast made to serve, that thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say. Now let's pause here for a moment. We are beginning a section of Isaiah, which is, if you are able to appreciate the original Hebrew, it is a song. So it would be like separated in some sense if it was printed on a page in modern printing. But Alec Motcher says this song of the fallen king, it goes from 14:4b through verse 21. No translation can reproduce the sweep and surge of this truly magnificent poem. It is the work of a master. Among known Bible writers, none but Isaiah could be its author. Okay?
So where does it start?
The second part of verse 4. So it's introduced by, and thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say. So, quote, the song starts there, and it goes through verse 21. And so even though, if you're like me and don't have the tools of understanding ancient Hebrew, you can't appreciate directly the beauty of this work, make a note in your mind that this is a truly magnificent poem, even though it doesn't rhyme. How hath the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased? The Lord hath broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. He who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he that ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted, and none hindereth. Okay, so this king that formerly was striking people continually, ruling in anger, he's being persecuted, and nobody's doing anything about it. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing. Yea, the fir trees rejoice at thee, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since thou art laid down, no feller is come up against us. Now, when I first read that, I was thinking in English terms, and you know, you got this feller and that feller, but it literally means no tree cutter. Okay, nobody who is cutting a tree, yeah.
I thought we went Southern Brogue or something.
Yeah.
Okay, Isaiah.
Yeah. No.
I see the poetry now.
See the poetry. Feller here, feller there, feller everywhere. But since you're laid down, nobody's coming up to cut us. And of course, the trees of Lebanon in the ancient world were of great reputation. The cedars and the firs were desired for, they were imported, I don't know how far, certainly into Egypt, for use in building, construction, everything from buildings to coffins. and it was renowned for its trees. And so, you know, there is something noble about a big, tall tree. But there's something noble about a beautiful piece of furniture made out of it, too. And you can't make the furniture without felling the tree, right? But, you know, there's two sides of me. When I walk into a beautiful woods, there's a certain remorse at having to cut it down. But it's just a way of life. It does grow back. It's been put there for our use. Contrary to the fake media, at least in the United States, we don't suffer from a lack of tree replenishment. We harvest 36% less than we grow every year. And so, there again, though, that's by government numbers. Who knows how accurate that is, but statistics, as somebody said, are made up 96% of the time. Just like that one. But certainly from my experience, I would say that timber comes back surprisingly fast. We have cut that timber around the mill there, I don't know, 5 times in my lifetime anyway, and it could be cut again. And I'm not that old. No feller is come up against us since thou art laid down. Hell from beneath is moved for thee to meet thee at thy coming. It stirreth up the dead for thee, even all the chief ones of the earth. It hath raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. All they shall speak and say unto thee, art thou also become weak as we? Art thou become like unto us? Thy pomp is brought down to the grave, and the noise of thy vials. The worm is spread over thee as a blanket, and the worms cover thee. So contrast this with all the absolute power that the ancient kings had over all things in their domain. Never thought in their mind about what would happen in the hereafter, where they were going, or the possibility that they might be mortal. And then suddenly, once they are dead, it's all done. It's all over. Rachel and I were watching a documentary about a king of France. Was it Louis the 14th? I believe. The Sun King. And he had absolute power, but he wrote a will, and he acknowledged that as soon as I'm dead, they'll break it. You know. Once I'm gone, I have no control. It's all over. And so I think Isaiah would have us give more heed while we're alive to the fact that there's coming a time when we don't have the power of life and we don't have the privileges that now are part of our world. And there might be some other things that are important. And so here's, and there's no specific king that we can absolutely tie this to. This is kind of a general address to kingness, kingliness that existed in the ancient world and in Babylon. Pomp, thy pomp is brought down to the grave. Noise of thy vials. I didn't look that up. I don't know what that means.
Harps.
Thank you. So, all the grand music associated with your processions and your activities. And then, best of all, you are blanketed with worms. Love that picture. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend unto heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the clouds, the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Okay, so Isaiah here uses some imagery which reflects ancient Canaanite mythology. The ancients often thought of gods living on mountains. Of course, we know about Mount Olympus, right, in the Greeks. Well, in this part of the world, they didn't care anything about Mount Olympus, didn't even probably know about it, but it was a different mount. The sides of the north seems to be a reference to a mountain that is far to the north. At the border of what now is Syria and Turkey, and was thought to have been the place that the gods of this part of the world resided. So the modern name is something, I'm not sure what the pronunciation happens with when you got a C with a little squiggly line at the bottom of it. But you can work on that in your spare time. I didn't have time to look that up. In some versions of the Bible, it is translated. I will show you. Let's see, we're looking for verse 13. So I think the NIV has a translation of it. Mount Zaphon. Okay. So that is a what Isaiah is describing. This Babylonian king had aspired to be on par with the gods, maybe even excelling them. I will exalt my throne above the stars of heaven. I will sit with that congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. By contrast, he says, yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit, as opposed to the sides. And that expression, sides of, the means the extreme. So instead of the extreme height, you go to the extreme depths, the other end of the extremes. They that see thee shall narrowly look at thee, or they shall stare at you and consider thee, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake kingdoms?
And this is still part of that beautiful song, right?
Yeah, this is part of the song. I guess it ends there, right? It was verse 16?
I thought it was 21.
Oh, you're right. Thank you. Is this the man that made the earth tremble, did shake kingdoms? And there have been many characters in history that we would say, yeah, that's kind of what we're saying. When you think it, you come to the end of World War II and the end that Hitler came to, the world looks at him and said, really? Is that how this ends? Another documentary I recently looked at talked about the widespread use of drugs in the Nazi army in order to accomplish their blitz technique. In some cases, they had to stay awake for 3 and 4 days. So they gave them amphetamines to make them stay awake. They had a mini sub that they were going to use against the Allies. But in order for it to operate, you know, people had to stay awake for days on end. And the drugs they gave them made them hallucinate. And so it didn't work out too well. You know, that's an image that had never crossed my mind. You grow up learning about the World War II and stuff and these armies and the things they did, and like, wow, they were high, you know?
They committed such atrocities at times.
Yeah, and Hitler was on so many drugs that they ran out of drugs to find a game, give him. He was a mess. So, yeah, you who, what did it say here? That made the world a wilderness and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners. All the kings of the nations, even all of them, lie in glory. He's talking about the great tombs and mausoleums that people built for the great kings, the pyramids. So all of them lie in glory. Of course, they've been robbed, but everyone in his own house, his own tomb. But thou art cast out of thy grave like an abominable branch. And as the raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with a sword, that go down to the stones, the foundations of the pit, as a carcass trodden under feet. Thou shalt not be joined with them in burial, because thou hast destroyed thy land and slain thy people. The seed of evildoers shall never be renowned. Okay, so this contrast between kings who have carried their glory with them into the afterworld, so to speak, by the grand structures that they build to commemorate their deeds and their life. He says of this one, you're going to be like a pile of carcasses that gets trodden underfoot. And then the last verse of this song, prepare slaughter for his children for the iniquity of their fathers, that they do not rise or possess the land, nor fill the face of the world with cities. So that was always an issue in the ancient world. Kingships tended to be hereditary. And it's a nice ringtone. It's not you. That's, relax, Trinda. Everything's going to be okay. It could have been rock and roll. But sometimes Pastor's phone used to play stuff that he didn't initiate, so I think we got that fixed, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
the music that your phone used to play that you didn't ask for?
Oh,
yeah. But anyway, so this reality of needing to watch out, because if you leave any connection to this former great king, it has such power in people's minds that they are much more willing to serve the offspring of a great king than they are some new contender to the throne. And so every generation of monarchs was concerned to have a successor. And every usurping monarch was concerned to get rid of all successors, if at all possible. And so that is what Isaiah is referring to here. You know, your kids don't have a chance. You're gone. Your power's gone. You've been evil. You have left a heritage of waste and destruction. And that is what is going to follow your children to their grave. Well, it is 11 o'clock.
Where it said Lucifer.
Yes, pardon me?
That wasn't referring to Lucifer, Satan, up there.
You know, some later commentators have tried to make a connection there. There seems to be, in some ways, some points of comparison. But the thing is, some of our ideas of comparing actually come from this passage. And so that's...
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it does. Most certainly the language has connections to the ancient Canaanite world. Lucifer just means morning star or something like that. Let's see here.
Day star.
Shining one, morning star. But it only... according to my data here, it shows up one time in the Old Testament. And so what do you compare it to, right?
Does Peter mention falling from heaven or something like that?
Well, Jesus refers to seeing Satan fall as lightning from heaven.
Okay.
Yes. Peter refers to the spirits kept in bondage, the judgment. So, I'm not sure that we can make any clear deductions about Satan from this passage. Isaiah's stated target is this idealized king of Babylon, which was embodied in several individuals, went from this state of aspirations to being a god to the lowest possible end. So, okay, thank you for your kind attention.